started to do was we got introduced to the concept of Zeborer, the idea that there's a Beis Din known nowadays as Zabla. Zabla, besides being almost as cool a sounding word as Zedidiah, is essentially a Rashi Tevis for Zeborer Lo Echad, that there is a way of composing a Beis Din through three parties, three Dayanim. The Dayanim would be selected one by one litigant, one by another litigant, and the third, it's a Machlokas in the Mishnah, either the two Dayanim pick the third, that's the position of Chachamim, or the position of Rebbeir, that the two litigants together pick a third Dayan. And we started off asking a couple of questions yesterday. So one thing we wanted to try to figure out is, what is this? What are we talking about all of a sudden? So is this the way Bati Din should be done? Is this some type of a backup plan? If we don't have a established Beis Din, what exactly is the purpose of this? So we had some comments about this, that we first tried to figure out, well, what makes sense to us? So would it be better to have a Beis Din like this, or would it be better not to have a Beis Din like this? So through some discussion yesterday, we came up with the idea that the downsides of having a Beis Din like this is that the Dayanim might be perhaps biased towards whoever selects them, and they may also not be qualified. They may not be such great Dayanim. They may just be whoever the litigant thinks is going to be a good advocate for him, but that's not necessarily a qualification. On the other hand, why might we think this is a good type of Beis Din? Because maybe there is something to be said for a buy-in, that the idea that the litigants have a feeling that they have contributed to the contribution of the Beis Din, the fact that they feel like, okay, I am represented, that perhaps is an advantage. And whether or not one is better than the other, we thought, we mentioned, as Rasalvechik and others pointed out, that maybe the Mishnah sounds like it's telling us this is the ideal. Dinimamunus b'shlosha, here's how you do it. The fact the Mishnah starts off saying that's dinimamunus b'shlosha, maybe that's significant. But on the other hand, it's not clear that that was always the girsa, besides the fact that we call the parak Zebora, but also the fact that we opened up the Rosh. You see, the Rosh doesn't start with those words. Maybe that wasn't the girsa he had. So maybe that's not the only way to read this Mishnah. Also, as we'll come back to in a few minutes, maybe one doesn't have to necessarily make such a diuk in these words, even if these words are indeed there. So that's something we'll come back to in a minute. So we then noted that the question of what is the value of this Beis Din, if the Beis Din does have an edge in terms of being listened to, because was composed through the input of the two parties, so then maybe that's something that we are particularly interested in, that maybe we want people to listen. We, clearly we do, but the question of how much of an emphasis do we put on the Beis Din being listened to? And that goes to the question of what is the purpose of a Beis Din in general. Is the purpose of Beis Din to be Mavara the MS? And then it's up to us to decide whether or not we are going to listen to it, or do we say, no, the purpose of the Beis Din is to bring about harmony through the truth of Torah. And if they paskin the truth, then that's good, but if no one listens, then they haven't done their job. And that's, we assumed that that point is together with the first point. Not that it's one or the other, that they're either going for harmony or the truth. They're going for the truth in both cases, but they haven't finished if they only got the truth, and they haven't gotten harmony. And then we got on from that point to discussing where we find that in other places in halacha, a focus on incorporating within the halacha that the Beis Din should be listened to, that maybe that's reflected, as some understand, in the halacha that a litigant who is the defendant has the right to say, you have to come into my town to do the Din Torah, because he's more likely, some explain, he's more likely to listen to the Dayanim from his town. And that the Orach Chaim said, that's why you have to have a Beis Din in every Shevet, because the people in that Shevet are going to be more receptive to their Beis Din. So maybe we find the Halacha does incorporate this as a value, and maybe that's the value here. So that's a lot of what we said yesterday. I think that's it's enough to progress with today. Did you have
didn't discuss yesterday whether the question of whether the third dayan is employed appointed by litigants or by the other dayanim, how that
excellent
speaks to the
Excellent segue. So that's like an infomercial. That's a great question, because that's one of the points we want to get to. So let's start with that, actually, now that you bring that up. So let's start with that. So before, just to add one point to what we just said a second ago, so it's interesting, this idea also, that we have a focus on the Dayanim not just getting the truth, but also carrying out the truth. So we know that the Torah tells us in the same breath, Shoftim v'shotrim, right, that we should have not only judges, but we should also have enforcement. So clearly, overall, we're interested in both. We're interested in having both of those things happen. And it's also interesting that, just to mention, Inyana d'yoma, in the sense of Inyana d'daf yomi. So first of all, mazel tov to Klal Yisrael that they finished Seder Nashim today. So tomorrow is the first day of Nezikin. So if you learn Bava Kamma, if you start learning Bava Kamma tomorrow, I don't know if anyone in this room is a Daf Yomi follower, so if tomorrow you plan on starting Bava Kamma, so there's a big question under the surface of what exactly is going on in Bava Kamma. Because Bava Kamma is about Nezikin, is about the idea of Mazik, that if you damage somebody's property, you are obligated to pay. That's clear from the Torah and Parshas Mishpatim, that you have an obligation to pay for the damages that you inflict. But what's not so obvious, what's not so clear, is that there's an Isser involved. What would happen if I would come with a sledgehammer and a checkbook, and I come and I decide I'm going to smash the window of your car, but don't worry, here's my checkbook, I'm going to pay you on the spot and cover all the costs. So would you say that that is Usser to do? I have to pay, I broke your windshield. But was that prohibited? So that's the kind of elephant not in the room, I guess. That's the hidden subtext to the beginning of Bava Kamma. Everyone wants to figure out, okay, we talk about the Chiyuv of Nezikin, we talk about the obligation to pay when there is a Hezek, but is it prohibited to do? And the Pashtus is, it is prohibited to do. It sounds like that explicitly from Rishonim, for sure, like the Rambam and others. But the question is, then where does it say that in the Torah? So there are many, many suggestions. It's not our topic for today. It's a little bit on my mind through the Daf Yomi connection. But just to mention what's relevant here is that this is a topic that was discussed by the Stipler in his first essay in Bava Kamma, Bava Kamma Siman Aleph, in the Kilas Yaakov. So he comes at it from two angles. He says that he thinks really the answer is it's Hashavas Aveda, that if the Torah obligates you to return someone's property that is either lost or is being physically destroyed, so then it must mean, Kal v'chomer, that you cannot be the one doing the physical destroying. And then he goes on to prove that that's true even if you are going to have a situation where the owner would lose all the value but still hold on to the object. It's still worth it to do Hashavas Aveda. So he goes on to say that it comes out that if somebody wants to break your stuff and say, I'm going to pay you back, what's your problem? I'm here ready to pay, so why can't I break your stuff? So if you had a Beis Din there on the spot, the Beis Din would stop that person from doing this prohibited act, from breaking your stuff. So therefore, he writes, based on the whole idea of Shoftim v'Shotrim, that there is a din that whenever a Beis Din would enforce something, that means it's a chiyuv on you to behave that way. So if we could say that if a Beis Din were here, they would stop you from doing this, that itself is a source that it's also for you to do it. So that's a possible perspective on where the prohibition of mazik comes from.
Having another Beis Din can legitimately stop you.
So he has a complicated drasha, basically, from the idea of Hashavas Aveda. He says that if, let's say, you have a situation where somebody's property is about to be lost, and it's going to cost you time to protect it, because you have to take off from work to go save it. So the Gemara says that if it's going to cost you more in lost wages than it'll cost him in the lost object, then you're not obligated to do it. So Tosfos says in Bava Metzia that, oh, so apparently if it's equal, you are supposed to do it. That if you lose, if it's a $50 item, and you lose $50 in salary by taking the time to do it, you should still do it. Now, why should you still do it? So if he's not going to pay you back for your lost times, then why should you lose anything? Whatever the comparison is, you shouldn't be obligated to do it at all. So the assumption here is that he's going to pay you back for your lost wages. So here, to save a $50 item, he's going to pay you $50 so that you should be compensated for your lost time. So Tosfos says, so what's the point? Right, if he's going to end up with the same $50 loss either way, so what's the point? So Tosfos has an explanation why it's still of interest to people not to lose their stuff. So the Stipler says, you see from here, that even if the person is going to have the same bank account before and after, still, people don't want their stuff to be lost. So therefore, that comes out that even if you're going to pay him for his destroyed object, you can't take away their item. This is interesting, by the way, because the psychologists talk about, I think we had the opportunity to mention this and share in a different context this year, something called loss aversion, that when somebody has something already, so they value it more than it's otherwise valued. They figured that out, that people are willing to pay a certain amount for an item, but once they have that item, they're not willing to part with it for that much money, they ask for more money, that people put more value on holding on to what they already have. So basically what we're seeing here in the dinim of Hashavas Aveda is that even if the person was going to have to pay as much money as it's worth to not lose it, they still would rather not lose it. So he says, so therefore it comes out that midinei Hashavas Aveda, you're obligated to stop this person from losing his stuff, even if it ends up balancing out monetarily. So therefore, a Beis Din presumably would enforce that too. If they had a Beis Din on the spot, the Beis Din would enforce this. So he does all that math together, and it comes out that if you had a Beis Din here, the Beis Din would say, you can't break this guy's windshield even though you're ready to pay for it. So that means without the Beis Din, it's also free to do it. That's the din of Shoftim v'Shotrim. It's a din that not only should the Shoftim impose the law, but the law becomes the reality, whatever the practical guidelines would be, become a mitzvah, you have to do that. So all of that, why am I mentioning all this besides for the Daf Yomi connection? So it just shows that inherent in the mitzvah of din, in the mitzvah of shoftim, is that they're going to carry out the practicalities of their law. They're going to make sure that it actually gets followed. So why is it all relevant to us? Again, because then maybe if we have a Beis Din, it's more likely to be listened to. Because the parties themselves contributed, so then that's inherently valuable. And maybe that becomes a preferable Beis Din. Hi. Did you have one?
Yeah, I hope I'm listening to you.
No, please.
How come you don't use it for...
Okay, so if you want to talk about that, so it happens to be a little off topic, but it's interesting. So many, including the Stipler, point to a Rabbeinu Yonah who says that Rabbeinu Yonah in Pirkei Avos, the first mission in Pirkei Avos, so Rabbeinu Yonah has a comment there where he says that Mazik is a violation of Gezel. Which is a chiddush. It's a little bit of a chiddush because one could have said that gezel means you're taking somebody's property for yourself. The idea that simply causing somebody a loss, even if you're not taking it, is also called gezel, is a chiddush. In fact, that's the whole point that it's a chiddush. That's why Rabbeinu Yonah says it over there, because he writes that the Mishnah says, first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, and that's good for us that Moshe received the Torah, because if it were not for Moshe passing the Torah on to us through the Masorah, we wouldn't know all kinds of things. And he says, as an example, you wouldn't know that Lo Sigzol includes being Mazik, somebody's property. So we're lucky that we have Moshe to teach us the Torah, because we find out all kinds of things you wouldn't know. So some want to invoke, including the Stipler mentions this also at the beginning of his discussion, this Rabbeinu Yonah as a source for Mazik. I'm not sure it fully answers the question. Because, yes, if I'm actually damaging people's property and leaving it that way, so then maybe you could make a good case that that is included in Gezel. And maybe that's Rabbeinu Yonah's point. But if the question we're asking is, if you're ready to pay for it, if you're ready to leave the person financially whole, as they say, So then how do you know that that's gezel? If you're not going to take away their net worth, you're just changing it from property to cash by breaking it, then paying for it. How do you know that that's called gezel? I don't know if that's clear from Rabbeinu Yonah that that's called gezel.
Well, for Geneva we have the...
So now you can say...
Geneva and gezel are very, very close.
So are they so close? So I think what you're going to say is that when it comes to Geneva, there's a prohibition. The Gemara tells us the prohibition of gonev amanas l'shalim, that you're not allowed to steal even if you're going to pay back. So then let's say, okay, so if mazik is gezel, so then even if you're ready to pay back, it's still usr. That might be true. However, there are those who distinguish between gezela and geneva for this purpose, which is a fascinating discussion. That gezela is essentially, this is also a Sanhedrin topic from the very beginning of the Masechta, that gezela is depriving somebody of their money, and geneva is depriving somebody of their money in a sneaky fashion, and not only taking away their stuff, but also deceiving them and fooling them. So it could be that the reason the Gemara says that you're not allowed to do that even if you're going to give it back is because, all right, you're not really depriving them of their money, they're getting the money back, but you're still being sneaky, and being sneaky by itself is prohibited. And therefore, maybe gezel, which doesn't involve sneakiness, maybe we don't have a specific prohibition if you're going to pay it right back. I don't have to agree with that, but I don't know, there's room to say like that. The Bach says, Bach has his own reason to say this, but the Bach makes that distinction. So if gezel is mazik, and mazik is gezel, then I don't know if we necessarily have a source knowing that it's usur, even if you're going to pay. It could very well be, certainly could be, but there's room to question whether or not the Rabbeinu Yonah about lo sigzol, whether that fully addresses the story. But it's definitely possible. Okay, so all of that is just relevant to this idea that whatever the Beis Din wants to tell you to do is a chiyuv on you, even in and of itself, and therefore there is a particular value to having a Beis Din that's more likely to be listened to. So then that could provoke the question, so what about the third Dayan? So first, one question to ask is, what exactly is the expectation? This question was brought up yesterday. We didn't have a chance to really get into it. So what exactly is the expectation on the Dayan that is selected by each litigant? So it's a tricky thing, because are we really hoping that he's going to advocate on behalf of his elector, whoever picked him, that he's going to take his side no matter what? That would be very problematic. Right? That would certainly be highly questionable from a halachic perspective. Right? We're not allowed to have biased judges. So are we saying here that you can have a biased judge because since you'll have one of each, they'll balance each other out? That's not really an acceptable way. Right? So presumably what we mean is that the Dayan is still going to be honest, but A, he will recognize that he was brought in there by this person, so at least he should make sure that all the issues are brought to the table, all the legitimate issues. And on the other side, that the one who selects him is going to have confidence that that will happen because he picked him. But we don't want to go too far with this because that's highly dangerous. And to say that he should actually advocate, regardless, on behalf of the person who selected him, is a very problematic premise. Now, what we can compare this to is we find, in general, when it comes to the Sanhedrin, let's say, you have a Beis Din that is dealing with Dinei Nefashos, for example. So the system of the Sanhedrin is different than the American court system. The American court system, let's say you have a capital case in the American court system, somebody's on trial for his life. So what's the makeup? You have a prosecutor who's trying to convince everyone that he is guilty. You have the defense attorney who's trying to convince everyone that he is innocent. And you have a jury who's supposed to evaluate the evidence, and the judge who's presiding over it. and witnesses who are providing the evidence. That's basically the those are basically the players in the American court system. In the Sanhedrin, it's very different. In the Sanhedrin, so the witnesses are essentially the prosecutors. The witnesses are there to make the case that this happened. And the judges are judge, jury, and defense attorney, because it's their job to evaluate what's in front of them and to preside, and also to provide the arguments the other way. So therefore we find, and we spoke about this a little bit earlier in the year, we find certain requirements of the Dayanim that they are obligated to look out for exonerating evidence. And so, for example, if you have a situation where a Dayan witnessed a murder, he actually saw it, so we say, he is not able to sit as a Dayan because he's not going to be effective in trying to argue for the innocence of this guy, which is a very striking concept. So we also find, for example, that the Gemara tells us, the Mishnah tells us, that the 21 or 23, really, 23 Dayan makeup of the capital Beis Din is because of a drasha on Psukim, Eda Shofetes, Ve'eda Matzeles, that when Eda represents 10, we need to have 10 who are saying he's innocent and 10 who are saying he's guilty, so that makes 20. Then you need one to break the tie, and then you need 3 because one can't break the tie by himself because that'll only be winning by one or losing by one. You can't execute somebody based on a difference of 1. So you have to ultimately have 23 Dayanim. So what do you mean when you say 23 Dayanim, 10 pro and 10 against? It doesn't mean that the 10 are actually paid advocates for innocence and the other 10 are employees of the government looking to prosecute. It means that theoretically within the makeup you have enough to bounce it off that way. So too, when you have 3 Dayanim here, so presumably we mean that you have one who is ready to represent all of the issues on behalf of one party, and one who is ready to bring up all the issues on behalf of the other party, but not that they're actively going to advocate like a paid representative and going to abandon impartiality. So it's a subtle distinction. It's not so easy, but it's a major point. So if you see here, again, we'll do it together because of the lack of marmakomos. So you see that Rashi over here, the Rashi that we saw yesterday, Rashi says that the advantage of having input in the Dayanim, this was Rashi Yetze Din Emes Lamito, says that Saisi Bale Dinin the Solver Hachayim Hareini Baatzmi Birarti Ha'echer V'Hayochal Hafech B'Zchuti Hayim Hafech. Right, that the person who put him there says, okay, I know that I had a fair shot, because if there was what to say on my behalf, he would have said it. And the Yonim themselves, they're happy to advocate all the Stadim because they were chosen by these parties. So what do you understand from Rashi? Is Rashi really saying you should advocate? So before you answer, be careful to say what to say about that, because you might get insulted by the Rush. If you take a certain understanding of Rashi, you may find yourself attacked by the Rush. I'll tell you what I mean. Because if you look at the Rush in Siman Beis, here in the back, in the Rush, in Perek Gimel in Siman Beis, so the Rush starts off this way. He says, Mipnei sheyesh chaserei das. Now here's the insult, right? There are some people who are not intelligent enough, toin b'divrei Rashi, and they mistake reading Rashi. When they learn from Rashi, that Dayan is obligated to look into the merit of the person who picked him. The Omeid Bimkomo, Lachafos Bidvarim, Asher Lo Kedin. Then he thinks that the purpose of this Dayan is to stand as a representative, Omeid Bimkomo, of the person who picked him, and to say whatever is in his interest, whether or not it accords with actual justice. V'nagu kama nashim livor lehem baltach buvos. And there are people who will now pick as a borer somebody who's very crafty and very clever and will come up with all the arguments that will work on their behalf. V'nitlin b'divrei Rashi shemashme sheyesho lahafich b'schusam. And they hang themselves, they rely on the words of Rashi, that says, oh, isn't that the job? The job of the borer is to advocate on behalf of the person who selected him. So if I have a din Torah, I'll find a sharp, clever, crafty kind of guy who knows all the tricks, and I will select him as my judge. And I have good basis because Rashi says that's what I should do. So the Rashi says to me, you're a chaser das. You're somebody who doesn't understand what Rashi is really getting at, and you're reading it wrong. Question about that?
Is this why he almost has to remind judges not to be orche dayanim?
Oh, so that's actually a fascinating discussion of itself. So what exactly that Mishnah means is a big discussion. It's a little off topic. And it's not totally off topic, so you know, maybe tomorrow we'll add some words about that, because you're right, it's relevant, you know, it's interesting. I wasn't thinking about that, but there's actually an interesting machlokus rishonim, how to read that Mishnah, so maybe let's save that for tomorrow. But it is actually more relevant than I even mentioned it. But in any event, so here, this is what the Rashi says, that this is what people do. They think that Rashi is saying it's okay. V'chalila v'chas, God forbid. Lo diktiku b'dvarav, they didn't read carefully. Shekasav, what did Rashi really say? Shekasav, the savri harei ani birarto. Right, they think that, okay, I picked him. What does that mean? Ki hu sover kach, shehafech v'zchuso yosem v'zchus ha'acher. U'mitoch zeh tzayis l'dinehen. So this person who picked him, he figures, okay, this person is going to advocate more on my behalf, and because of that, he listens to them. Aval ha'dayin atzmo, but the judge himself, chalilolo limso svar l'zchuso, God forbid that he should find a position to exonerate this guy, im lo sheyiru lo din gomer, unless it happens to be that he really thinks that's true. But if he doesn't really think that's true, God forbid he should take such a position. Avalam hayochel ahatos is chaver lekabel svaroso. If he's so clever that he's able to trick his colleagues to accomplish, to follow what he is saying here, afal pi shehu mesupuk bo, though he doesn't really know that this guy is innocent, but he knows how to convince his fellow judges that he is, because he's clever enough and he's persuasive enough. Harei zeh b'chlal mateh mishpat. So then that's a violation of the iser of perverting the law. Yes, sir?
I don't really understand this dichotomy of Rush, meaning we want to give the impression of the litigant that the judge is being clever and sly on his behalf, but the judge shouldn't actually be. But if the problem is that we're afraid he's going to select a sly and clever judge, then if he retains this impression that that's what the judge is supposed to do, that's who he's going to choose.
Okay, so now that's an important point. So let's finish his words and let's then address what you're saying, because clearly there is a very subtle balance here. Before we saw the Rush, there was a subtle balance. Now, seeing his words, it's clearly a very narrow space that he's occupied. So let's just read the rest of his words first and then come back to that. Aval mitosh zabiro mevin dvarav la'ashurav v'yem yeshlo shum satzchus nosim nosim chavero v'chein osa hadayin ha'acher l'sheini. So, it's a little unclear, to tell you the truth, how far the Rush is willing to go. Because your point is well taken, and it's a little bit open for discussion just how far he's taking this. That he seems like he's basically saying that we don't really expect this Dayan to push a point on behalf of one side or the other, because that would be wrong. We don't expect him to do so in a way that overcomes the actual truth. That just because he was quote-unquote hired, or hopefully quote-unquote, not literally, hired by one party, so then that should mean that he should push this position no matter what. That's not right. So what's the value? The value is that the one who picked him will have confidence that his positions are accurate, are fairly represented. Now, where the Rush leaves a little bit of room, and I think this is what you're picking up on, is he could mean two things. He could mean that everyone is on the same page here, that the Dayan is not supposed to say anything outside of what he thinks is the actual truth, but he is expected to fairly bring up all the issues and have them hashed out. So because he was brought on by one side, so that will push him to make sure that the issues that have to be aired out will be aired out, and the other Dayan will do the same, and therefore all the issues will be there, and the third Dayan will hear all the issues, and essentially he'll guide the discussion to a fair and just conclusion. And the litigants realize that that's what's going on, and therefore they're also confident, not that they're confident that the judge is going to ram through their position no matter, that they ran through the position no matter what, but they're confident that if there was any way that their position deserved to be right, it wasn't because it wasn't stated. That whatever had to be said was said, and if they lost, then they lost kiddin. Now that's the most, I think, idealistic reading of the Rush. That's what's going on, the most idealistic reading of what should happen. Right? That puts everything just in the very just kind of perspective. We just want there to be advocates on behalf of all the issues getting out there, and that's what this system does, and that brings about the truth, and therefore we're really having a lot of confidence in a person's ability to be Lishma. But the same way we discussed earlier in the year that the Gemara says if somebody loses in Beis Din, you shouldn't be upset. He should be happy, but apparently he had somebody else's property, Shalokidin, and now he was saved from that. So now he's no longer holding on illegitimately to somebody else's stuff. HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped him from having this on his conscience, having this on his responsibility, was taken care of. So within all that kind of perspective, we could say here that that's what we want. We want somebody to know, okay, if I lose, I lost, but I lost Kidin. I lost because there was a fair panel that went through everything, and realize that I deserve to lose. So I don't mind losing if I deserve to lose. But I don't want to lose because the judges just didn't catch on to all the issues that had to be discussed. And the judges just didn't realize what could be said. But if they realized and they argued it out, then I lost. Okay. So that's an idealistic vision of how we could hope people will behave. And it could be that that's what the Rush is saying. There's a little bit of room to say, like you were suggesting, that maybe there's a little bit of a space between the judges and the selectors, that the litigants, that the judges themselves, same story like we just said, they're obligated to act that way, that they have to bring up all the relevant issues, but they cannot deviate from what they think is the actual truth, and they can't try to convince their other parties, to other colleagues, to vote one way that they don't actually believe is the truth. That's still the case. But maybe the litigants don't totally hot that's what's going on. Maybe the litigants do think that they're getting a little bit more impartial representation on their behalf from their judges. And that's good because it means that they're more likely to listen. So we'll kind of harness their shalol lishma attitude to the benefit of the truth that, okay, they think they're getting a deal they're not actually getting. But that's good because it will bring them closer to actually following the din that will come out true because of this makeup, and that's an advantage too. That's a slightly less idealistic vision of what's happening, but theoretically that could be read into here as well.
Seems to read better in Rashi than the other option also.
Maybe.
Because Rashi is very specific that he's being mahabed for him.
Although, but it's not impossible to read it the idealistic way, right? Let's look at it again. And so what could Rashi be saying if you look at the idealistic way? Did Saisi Bali Dinin, they're going to listen. The Savri Hachayev, so the Savri Hachayev, the one who ends up losing will think, Hare ani ba'atzmi birarti yo'echad v'im hayayochel la'hafeich b'zchusi hayim ha'hafeich. That if it was possible for there to be anything in my defense, it would have been said. So I trust that it was said and that it was outvoted. So it's not impossible to read it within the Rashi. So I think both readings theoretically could be in the Rush. We'd like to prefer the idealistic reading just in terms of our vision of humanity. But the important point that comes out of the Rush, but the unquestionable point and the point of the Rush is so emphatic about in terms of talking about the Chaser Das and the like, is that one thing we know is that the Dayanim are not allowed to deviate from what they believe to be the truth. They cannot either vote for their litigant just because their litigant picked them, or, as he describes, try to convince the other judges to vote for a position that they themselves are not sure is actually correct, just because it happens to represent their party's interests. So this Rush, written so many centuries ago, it's interesting because this is probably relevant to our contemporary story today. So we're going to have to say more about this. We'll have to continue this point tomorrow. I think tomorrow we'll start with that point about the third Dayan and about the Orchei Dayanim also. It's an important issue, so we'll put those two on the top agenda for tomorrow. But the question, which we have to get into more detail about, is that nowadays, so we are going to find a discussion about, like we said, is Zabla ideal or is it B'dieved? And how does it rank against other options, such as having an established Beis Din, having a superior Beis Din, if there's a clash as to which one to go to, so what wins, Zabla or the other choice?
Is it more than one option, besides Zabla versus a fixed Beis Din?
That could be one possibility. Also, what if it's a Beis Din that's somewhere else, let's say?
Which Beis Din to go to?
Right, like, let's say, for example, you have two people have a fight in Washington Heights. So let's say there was an established Beis Din in Washington Heights. So the question is, we could either go to that established Beis Din or we could do a Zabla. That might be one scenario. Or let's say there's no established Beis Din in Washington Heights, but there's a good Beis Din in Brooklyn. We're not in Brooklyn, but we know that there's a pretty qualified Beis Din in Brooklyn. So we could say, let's get up and go to Brooklyn because they have good Dayanim there. Or we could say, let's have a Zabla here. So if you have a dispute between those two positions, who's going to win? Who's going to have the upper hand in saying, my system is better? So that's a halachic discussion with Makoros, which we'll see more of hopefully tomorrow. But nowadays, one could wonder whether it matches the Makoros. You'll hear people recommend nowadays sometimes to avoid Zabla. So why will they tell you to avoid Zabla? Could be for any number of reasons. But maybe they perceive that the reality is like what the Rush is talking about, like what the Rush is criticizing. They'll say, oh, you may have the pure image of what's described here in the Mishnah and in the Rishonim, but what's actually happening is that this guy you're in a fight with, he is going to hire, so to speak, again, either with quotes or without quotes, he is going to put on this Beis Din somebody who's going to be a shark and ram through his position no matter what, and it's not A, beneficial to the other guy, or emes lamito. So if you're looking for truth and you're looking for a fair shake, some might say avoid Zabla. So that would be working off a premise that whatever the halacha actually is telling us, the reality might not accord with that, and that might be a issue. Now, it's interesting also to reflect, to give a little bit of a defense to the Chesed Das position, that if we do compare it to, and this is a little bit of an open question, if we do compare it, let's say, to the American system, right? So the American system, so you have defense attorneys, and you have, well, let's say we're talking about civil litigation here, so you'll have a plaintiff and a defendant, right? So you have attorneys on behalf of each side, and yes, those attorneys, for sure, are paid to advocate on behalf of their parties, their litigant. So, yes, it is expected that the plaintiff's attorney will only advance the arguments that benefit the plaintiff and will paint his position in the best possible light. And it's expected that the defense will do the same thing for his party. Now, does that mean the system is unjust? We don't think so necessarily. We think that the idea of having an adversarial system means that between the two of them duking it out, if they're of comparable stature, which isn't necessarily always the case, but if they're of comparable capability, you'll get the truth, because each one will take a position and push it so hard that the jury, theoretically, will be able to see them each giving each position its all, and they'll therefore vote. So, theoretically, one could have imagined the model that the Rush is saying is so terrible here, that maybe even within the perspective of justice, yeah, let's have a system where you have two dayanim, each one is mamish going to push one guy one side no matter what, but because you have the third guy who's supposed to be objective, the third dayan will then evaluate ki'ilu, he is the jury, that one dayan is the jury by himself, and the other two dayanim are indeed going to be partial advocates on behalf of whoever selected them, and that will still bring out the truth, hopefully, in a way that we hope the American system brings out the truth. So maybe there could have been a room to say such a position, honestly, but in any event, that's what the Rush is saying, that that's not acceptable, that's not a vision within halacha. Now, of course, within the American system also, there's a question of just how far an advocate can go for his client, if his client, let's say, for example, if he knows his client is guilty or if he knows that his client's not telling the truth, there are limits to how zealously a lawyer, even a paid advocate, can go. So that still leaves some room for discussion, but maybe, at least theoretically, there could have been some kind of svara for this model that the Rush is so down on, and could be what to talk about, but in any event, he takes a pretty clear stance here. So, an unclear stance about what are we thinking that the litigants are thinking, but a very clear stance about what he expects of the Dayan. Hi.
It's a little bit relevant, but when he said that the situation where we know that one side is guilty, one side is innocent, a different situation, but that idea of being guilty and being innocent isn't so clear at all. And most of the time, it's not my idea, I've seen this in a couple times in text, but that you usually assume that even the guilty side has a side of chos.
You're talking about, let's say, in the Mominus case? So, sometimes yes and sometimes no. I mean, it depends. There are circumstances. That's where, for example, we talk about pshara, so that usually reflects that there are cases like that. But not every case is like that. Let's say, for example, I swiped Jed's wallet out of his pocket, and he takes me to bed and says, I took his wallet, and he wants it back. So there isn't really much of a side. I mean, there could be cases that are more complicated, but there are situations that are less complicated. So sometimes we'll have a situation where, I don't know, you and I are fighting, we're roommates and we're fighting over the rent. And I say that I took care of the utilities, and you said, well, you don't use the utilities. You know, we could have arguments, well, should those kind of things be 50-50, or should they be based on whoever uses it more? And then, okay, each one of us has an argument, and the two sides could argue about which argument is more compelling. And so you have situations where it's not so cut and dry, and then you have cases which are cut and dry, and you have cases in the middle. So it could be any one of those. So perhaps you could say in the situation of the rent, okay, so then let one dayan come in there and push all the different reasons why it should be 50-50, and let another dayan come there and push all the reasons why it should be based on usage. And okay, that's a legitimate kind of fight. But if you have, I stole his wallet, and my advocate's going to go out there and give all the reasons why I shouldn't have to answer any questions, as Rav Schachter sometimes mentions as an example of what you find going on improperly in some bat they did, or something like that, so then that's not at all connected to truth or justice. So it depends a little bit on what kind of situation we're talking about. Okay, so I think, again, we're at that point where we'll have to stop here. So Be'ez Hashem tomorrow, so we want to pick up from talking about the third dying. This is a major issue. I'll tell you, just in terms of Marmakomos now, that, in case I don't give a list, that this issue of the third dying, if you look on the Mishnah, look, there is a Nachlokis between the Bart Nuro and the Rambam on one side, the Rambam in Perish Mishnayos, and the Bart Nuro on the Mishnah, and the Tosfos Yontif. So take a look at that in terms of the third dayan. That's one thing we'll talk about. And we also said we'll talk about Al Tiukarach HaDayanim. So you can look at that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos and look at the Rambam over there as well. Get some interesting nekudas. Maybe we'll pick up with those points and hopefully talk about more about the practicalities of whether one Beis Din wins out over another benefit. If you look at the Ran over here also, the Ran quotes Machlokas about that. So these are all good Marmakomos to work with. So instead of putting out a list, look at the Ran over here. Look at the Rambam, how he brings these halachos. Look at the Rush in Choshen Mishpat. Look at the Ramah in Choshen Mishpat Aleph Gimel. And look at the Mishnah over here with the Rambam and the Bart Nur and the Tosfos Yontif. Okay? So we'll, God willing, pick up on this 5 o'clock tomorrow. And I wish everyone a wonderful day.